So today is Wednesday, August 16th, 2017, and I'm in studio with a poet and sage elder of the community, Arnold Adolph. And we're here today because I am working on a project to bring the life and love and literature of the Hamilton Adolph legacy to our listeners in a half hour, I hope, project that will air maybe sometime around the holidays, I'm hoping. But in doing that, I was encouraged to do it because we have in the WYSO archives two archival audio pieces from the early 1980s. That one is an interview with Virginia, and in 1981, I believe it was produced by Willa Seidenberg, who at that point would have been a graduate of Antioch College and working here at the station. And the other is an interview with you, Arnold, and produced by Marcy Silman, and 1983, and talking about poetry, especially poetry for children. And I wanted to ask you a couple of questions and also hear you read some of your more recent work. That was one of the cool things about this. These two pieces, both of them have your work and Virginia's work read aloud, and it's pretty wonderful. So
let me pop in one
you go right
word
ahead.
That may be relevant or not. Marcy was a friend at the time, and she and I were going to do a radio a show at WYSO. And so we got together. We did that interview. But then I distinctly remember having an interview audition with whoever was the station manager at the time. And they weren't particularly interested in doing it. So it was going to be called Poet and a One-Woman Band, which is instead of the Simon and Garfunkel Poet and a One-Man Band, and it would be a male-female music and poetry, and maybe we were ahead of its time. But my new blog is called Poet and One-Woman Band, so you always recycle. And so I recycled it to my own use.
Well, I'm going to start at the beginning, and we're going to get to a Poet and a One-Woman Band pretty soon.
Sure.
But I wanted to start by asking you some questions about what brought you to Yellow Springs, how what life was like in the New York City of the 50s, and what that transition was like. And I know that's a lot going on.
How many hours have you got? And which version do you want? PG-13, R?
Well,
triple
I think
X?
I want the version. I want the version that makes the most
sense. You want reality.
I want reality.
I was born and raised in New York City in the Bronx, and went down to Manhattan into the Village as a very young man. I snuck into Birdland, the jazz club, when I was like 13 or 14. To see some jazz, extraordinary jazz musicians. I was always drawn towards jazz and never thought I would leave New York, and thought it was a long enough journey to go from the Bronx to Greenwich Village or the Village, west side of Lower Manhattan, in my lifetime, and that would be quite enough. And I went to City College, which is now the City University of New York, Columbia University Graduate School. So I have an unfinished PhD on Harry Hopkins and the beginning of the New Deal, and I have all the graduate credits to be a history and political science major. So I'm a renegade in many, many ways. And when the dean interviewed me to get me into Columbia grad school, he said, "I'm going to admit you, but you're not going to finish. He said, you spend too much time down in the five spot." He knew Monk, who was working there every night and whatnot. So he was absolutely correct. I learned a great deal from these extraordinary historians. although at that time they were all male and they were all white, and they had been for generations. But I learned work that skills and process that I would use in my first published books, which were anthologies. So I'll fast forward a little bit to 1958, and I was through with grad school and spending all my time down the clubs. I was very much a groupie of Charles Mingus, although they didn't use the term groupie at the time. And I'd met him in the early 50s as an undergraduate. We became good friends. He taught me many wonderful, positive, and a few negative things. And in the end, I became his manager, his kind of white front man in sometimes indifferent and hostile white-dominated society. Later on, I'll fast forward you to the 60s when Virginia and I began to publish in 67 and 68, and I became her agent and her manager and her trip organizer while still being a poet and doing my own stuff. But I also was the verbose and verbal white guy in the front who did the talking, while she was the extraordinary genius that she was, who kind of laid back and smiled and didn't have to engage. So that's really a broad brush of how things began. In 1958, I would see her on the streets of the village, and I had a job, which meant that once a week or twice a week, I did per diem subbing for the New York City schools, and I made $26 and change. And if it was once a week even, $26 was enough for you to live on. Rent was $60 a month. Hamburger was 49 cents a pound. You could buy steaks. We were eating red meat without a second thought. And I'd lend her $5 now and then. And we became that kind of, we'd see each other at parties, and we each had different social and, life involvements. But one night when she and her friend were at the Half Note, and Mingus was playing, and Sonny Rollins was playing, and Mingus was taking longer and longer sets because he wanted to knock Sonny off the bandstand. And if one musician did that long enough, another musician might say, screw it, and bail out and go. And that was kind of one of his plays that he did. But while he was talking, while he was playing, I was talking. And I didn't have the term rapping, too. But whatever it was, I was establishing myself as an available, adoring male or something like that. So he dropped her off at her apartment. And as she was getting out of the car, I said, what's your number? And she gave me her number. And then I didn't want to go to where we were going to go later on after the club closed, because I was running that number. I didn't dare write it down because I would have really gotten a lot of good-natured abuse. These were men in their 30s and 40s, and I was, still in my early 20s and from an entirely different culture in many ways, race only being one part of it. But when we got home, I called her up. It was 2 in the morning, and I read her my poetry because that's all I really had. And I was over the next day, and she showed me immediately that she didn't have a radiator in her apartment. So it had been freezing, and how extraordinary it was. I think it was a compliment that she stayed and listened and didn't hang up on me. But we were together from that day through marriage and the night she went to have our firstborn. So that's all she wrote. It was beyond love at first sight. It was cosmic and spiritual and everything that I didn't even know existed at the time. 2 days later, I went to have dinner with my mother up in the Bronx on the way to the National Guard Armory, where I was a member of the Guard. And she said, "What's new?" I said, I met this woman, she's black, and I'm going to marry her." And that was the end of the conversation, as far as I was concerned. As far as they were concerned, it was another, you know, cause for bringing in psychiatrists and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the story, and that's how we met. And by 69, New York had gotten very difficult to live in. We were on the Upper West Side instead of the Village, but the whole Haight-Ashbury scene, and for listeners who are of a certain age or not of a certain age, you have to Google up and see what was happening in Haight-Ashbury and see what was happening with poetry and jazz, and also a heavy, heavy drug, an ugly scene that had come from California to New York, along with the marvelous, wonderful, poetic and musical blending and evolving that to me was extraordinary. So you couldn't push the kid in the baby carriage down Broadway without some ugly scene or without even real violence. So we said, let's go back to Yellow Springs and build a house on the last couple of acres of Virginia's family farm. And so she really kidnapped me off the streets of New York. But it was a brilliant idea, and it changed me in all the ways that I've been allowed to change and grow. And we built a house in 69. And was close to her mother when other siblings had gone or off into other places. So it was wonderful all around. Our kids grew up here in town, in the best of circumstances. Is that the whole picture? That's the whole picture.
Well, it's almost like you read my notes a little bit, because you've answered several of the questions that I had about the transition from the city to rural Ohio. But a question I would have to follow that up is, what was it like raising a family in Yellow Springs? And if you can make some comparisons between then and now.
Well, this is a nation, and we are seeing it in Charlottesville and with the Mr. 45, although he doesn't even deserve the Mr. appellation. But it's a nation where the original sin of chattel slavery has still not been solved, mitigated, or whatnot. And so people look at a biracial family. And we were married in 1960. The Loving case, and there's recently been a movie, I believe, was 69. So when we were 67, so when we were married in 60, our marriage was illegal in 28 states. And when people hear our story, they say, well, you know, you're talking black and white, you're talking race. But that's only one element. Geography, I call things the tyranny of geography, the tyranny different ways of making chicken or of cooking or of viewing the world. Fortunately, Virginia's family, although rural based on the western outskirts of this town, would get Crisis magazine and had connections with Dr. Du Bois, and it was a sense of more of a cosmopolitan African-American experience. For years, I yearned for New York, and it wasn't until I got much older and a little more beat up that I said, well, I don't feel like going through the whole thing of flying out there. And many of the jazz musicians who I adored and worked with had left the earth. And I tried to go and see them before they left. But all of that coexisted with Virginia's value system, based on race and gender and all that she had studied and her parents and her rebelling from some of her parents' values. And when you put that mix together, everything in there except okra, she didn't like slimy okra, but all of that together, that's how we raised our kids. We were extraordinarily close in so many views and so many values that we would say we give equal indifference to both sides of the Judeo-Christian tradition, and you know that kind of closeness in perspective. And we were, you know, our kids knew that I didn't drive, and Virginia did, and if they left their lunch, you know, I'd make it, and she could drive us up to the middle school or down to Mills Lawn and do that extra, you know, and do that extra effort. We didn't use the term house husband. She was home writing, and I was home writing, and we considered it, you know, self-employment. I don't really think of large elements where we had strong disagreements in terms of raising the kids. We had a concept that if they worked hard, we supported them, and they always worked hard, and that's really all that we required. Everything else we assumed, we realized that they were free to experiment and to learn and to become the people that they wanted, that they really wanted to be. Virginia's family, not so much, but my family wanted me to follow in the footsteps. And I'm always amazed when some surgeon has a kid who's a surgeon. How did they do something like that? You know, it. We immediately from the front said, it's your life. You become the person you want to become. It was a good town. They encountered racism playing on integrated sports teams that would go out to all-white sports teams from some of the all-white communities that existed more so than today, surrounding this, you know, so-called Shangri-La. And they learned values, and they learned, you know, how to be a humane human, and they learned empathy, and a lot of that they learned from their peers. They may have swam in that pond at home, but basically they're, as with all kids during all times, their conversations were with their peers and their questioning and their answers, right or wrong, came out of a marvelous group of young people growing up at the time in town. And people like your father, who who was Jamie's little league football coach. They didn't call it little league at the time, but
Pee-wee.
There was always something going on that brought kids together. And there was, of course, always town and gown, and there was always white privilege, although the term was not used at all, really, at the time. Maybe that's progress, that white people say they have white privilege now compared to 30 years ago or 40 years ago. But they were dealing with the next generation, with their generation.
You know, I know from reading Virginia's words and speeches that growing up, she had two things, I think, that were great influencers. One was that sense of freedom that she had living on a farm and having the ability to roam and experience just the sort of solitude and inspiration of being in that natural rhythm of the life on the farm, but also the storytelling from her that previous generations from her parents. And I wonder how that might have transferred to Jamie and Lee, who are also artists in their own right.
until Jamie got this teaching job at the middle school, or actually at Springfield High School a couple of years ago, we used to brag that nobody had a J-O-B. And, you know, we were, like, proud. And Jamie would say, when I have my kid, if they're not Mozart at age 7, they're going to study accounting and science and enough of the arts. Each of our two children have gone through the struggles and come on through the other sides in terms of being artists in America. We didn't say, you know. In fact, Jamie had a rock band, alternate rock band. He graduated from Central State as a percussionist and went to graduate school and studied jazz vocals and composition. He had a rock band in New York and around for 8 or 9 years. And finally, he really got disgusted with that world and the recording industry, quasi-criminals who control it and still do. But he was starting to work on a novel before he moved back from New York to Yellow Springs 8 or 9 years ago. And he called up, and Virginia rarely answered the phone, but she did this one time. And he said, "Mom, I'm going to join the family business." And she said, "And what would that be?" So it was always held at a bit of a distance. And you did really what you couldn't live without doing. Lee fell in love with opera at an early age. She starred in Scott Joplin's opera Treemonisha. How she sang that difficult role in middle school, I still really don't know. But I was in love with Sarah Vaughan, the extraordinary jazz vocalist with a marvelous range. And Lee was in graduate school, and we'd come into New York, and I'd take her to Tower Records and load her up with all the Sarah Vaughan cassettes, which is what they had at the time, you know, trying to influence this kid into the jazz world, because Lee also had an extraordinary vocal instrument, but it was only opera. I used to say, "You must have learned it in the gutter, kid." I didn't, you know, you didn't get that at home. But she persevered and got a graduate degree in opera performance. And, you know, I mean, her whole life has been devoted to that, as she runs a studio now, her own studio in Berlin, where she coaches and teaches young people who come to Berlin to try to break in. So she doesn't travel and spend those weeks away from home that she did when she started out. It just all happened very organically. Lee does not write that much, and I always claim that she was the best writer in the family. But she, I think, consciously or subconsciously has shied away from doing something that is in the realm of what her mother did. Jamie is a superb writer, and he left it to come back to Yellow Springs to teach, and he was disgusted with the whole corporate structure. But anybody in any of the arts will end up saying the same thing. That's just the nature of art in a capitalist society. It's capitalism first, and second, and third, and maybe you come a distant, fourth.
You know, that was one of the things that I found interesting about the speeches and essays, and both of the archival tapes. Both of you talk a lot about the industry, about the publishing industry, about the agents, about the publishing houses, about the work involved. And certainly looking at the compilation of essays and speeches, there are vast networks of organizations and awards and accolades to be garnered.
There are.
But it seems like that only happens to a few. And just say a little bit about that industry, especially back then.
Well, things have changed, certainly. They were changing, and by the economic crash that happened in 2008, it gave these corporations the ability to gobble up big fish, little fish. And so if we had five houses to send your manuscript to, just as a one small example, today there's one. I love some of the editors who are still alive, but one used to be a Random House editor. She's still a Random House editor, but Random House is now owned by it escapes me who it is, somebody, Viking, and somebody in England owns Viking, smaller houses, and I've published with smaller houses. Their imprints are part of larger houses. In general, we had wonderful editors back in the 60s when we started who would take us to conferences. Virginia made an extraordinary splash in 1967 with Zeely, and it was almost like no one had ever known that a young black girl would come from New York, the characters in the fiction, and live in a small town like Yellow Springs and walk along Wright Street up to the swimming pool, and there were the giant catalpas, and you could live. You know, this was like revelatory to all of these reviewers and whatnot. But it was only natural, what we call natural process. It was only just part of her life. But it won all kinds of awards and put her out there so that whatever she wanted to do, she was wonderfully successful in many ways. Commercially, she was wonderfully successful, not just for an African-American woman writer. You have to remember that those were the days in the 50s and 60s when women writers would change their names to, J.W. Smith, because they didn't want it known that they were females. Or editors would say, and occasionally I hear that still today, boys will only read boy characters, and girls, particularly up until they get to be in high school, and young adult novels, graphic novels, have pulled things out into more of a sophisticated reality, the handheld devices that open up for a kid the whole world. But editors would say that, and so, do you mind changing your protagonist from a young female to saying that to a female writer, to a male? She never got that. Virginia was one of those geniuses. I should go to the very end of the story after she died of breast cancer in 2002. The Library of Congress got in touch, and you have to sign this ironclad agreement. All her papers and manuscripts are in the Library of Congress. And so that's a wonderful accolade. But they're there with Steinbeck and Richard Wright and people. One of the many things that she always said very loudly was that there's room on my chest, for being black, for being a woman, for being an African-American woman, a novelist, and to be considered on the very highest levels. So her career, the other aspect of her career was she never wrote a piece of crap. She never had, because the two of us were working together in the same field, and I was her agent for many, many years, and giving her, I must say, excellent advice, and also negotiating extraordinary contracts I learned really at the knee of editors who would take us out in the 60s and taught us, and what they didn't say was what was important, or what they couldn't say, even though they claimed not to be corporate. But they knew what they were doing, and they knew that I would be able to negotiate a 10-book contract for this woman because she'd won the National Book Award and the Newbery Medal and, you know, on and on and on and on. Unprecedented. Never, I think, to the level that some of her less skilled white contemporaries. If she won one Newbery Medal, she should have won six. But the committees change from year to year, and they will give an award to there's a cultural ethnocentricity. So they feel a certain empathy towards a white writer who creates white characters, and that writer may get a second Newbery. That's really, in the scheme of things, it's not that important. In the deepest sense, it's crucial. It took over 30 years from the 70s until just a few years ago for an African-American illustrator to Jerry Pinkney to get a Caldecott Medal. And these committees are changing, and even the addition of Black and Hispanic and Asian librarians or teachers didn't change things that much for 30 or 40 years. We're at a time, and I'll fast forward to the very end, where figures have been released to show that over 3,000 or so children's books or young adult are published, and maybe 90 have people of color characters and authors and illustrators. So that's not that much of an improvement. And the one thing that people do not talk about is how few people of color are employed and work, just like we don't really, you know, talk about housing, or we don't talk about, you know, whatever. I don't need to belabor the point. But things have changed very, very little. So I always end my emails, "The struggle continues." And it really is a continuing struggle from when we became aware in the 50s and 60s to, to now, and to the young people coming in. Extraordinary number of talented, brilliant, talented African-American, not even saying, you know, Asian, Hispanic. You add those in, there are dozens of extraordinary people writing for young people and illustrating for young people. It's the richest of times, I think, really, since the 60s spilling over into the 70s. And for me, that's wonderful, deciding to, after she died, to get rid of wherever we were living in Culebra, Puerto Rico, or in New York City, and just make my home here in Yellow Springs, but to stay here, but with Facebook, which is lovely. I can't do Twitter, but with or anything else, I can barely do Facebook. But it keeps me in touch with the next generation and the next generation, and occasionally conferences that we go to. I'll put a plug in for the Kent State Conference Multicultural Literature for Youth that was begun. I think it's coming up on 35 years, and there's Virginia Hamilton Awards for the body of her work, and this will be the third year for the Arnold Adolph Poetry Award that fosters and attempts to encourage publishers to publish. When I say people of color, I mean the awards have been given out to African Americans and Japanese Americans and Asian Americans and Hispanic, and only just in 3 years. So So you see how rich things are when you approach anything in this country. And now we're getting back to yesterday's news conference. But when you approach anything in this country with the open mind for a true multicultural country that values all equally and all literature equally, we still have literary and artistic and dance and theater hierarchies where white or Eurocentric creations are valued higher than people of color or those of African descent or Asian descent. And that's so there's plenty of room for struggle. But, you know, things are opening up sporadically here and there. And even though the publishers have a death grip on who they hire and who they promote and who they put in their places as the gatekeepers, there are still more and more people coming in as librarians and as teachers and as members of groups that agitate for the kind of open literature. All of these organizations that you referenced before all have groups that meet and foster and attempt to push as best they can a multicultural publishing list. To get way back to your original thing, it was interesting to me. The business was interesting to me, and I learned the business. And then I realized that if I became Virginia's agent instead of a wonderfully nice woman, actually John Steinbeck's agent, but if I became the agent, we could keep the whole 10%. So I was being very the way I was raised. You know, you keep if you can keep the 10%, you keep the 10%. And once I became the agent, I became, if I do say so myself, the best agent in youth literature. And some of that I learned from Mingus, who tried to create an organization that went beyond ASCAP and BMI. And those of you who need to Google that up, feel free, and have something where the artist was protected. If you're a painter, you walk into you have a struggle to get a show. And you go into the gallery, and you could be extraordinary, but the gallery owner gets 60% and you get 40%. And that's the way it always was. And so some things don't change. Those writers and illustrators and teachers and librarians can only go just so far in pushing these publishing houses, or they find themselves without entree and without jobs many times. Very subtle, you know, the way we see racism in this country sometimes. The lynching is subtle, and the tree is not there, and the rope is not there, but it's the lynching none the same.
I must have
covered everything.
But, well, you just about right have. You just
good
about
Lord.
Have. That's, for me, a good segue into talking about self-publishing and doing the work that you are right now with A Poet and One Woman Band. And so there's sort of two things that I want to talk about. One is that the freedom that you have to do that, how that makes that transition from that publisher, that death grip that the publishing houses have on work to self-publishing your work. And also the content of the work, how that has changed from work you've done in the past,
absolutely.
And then we'll get to maybe reading some of it.
When my kids were younger, I did dozens of picture books, illustrated picture books, and I tried to be subversive in that I attempted. After the Xenia Tornado, for example, I did a book called Tornado. And they were individual poems, but they did them. So I was able to be a poet and create poetry, but it was a single narrative that told the story of the beginning, middle, and end, you know, of the Xenia tornado, which happened in April of 74. And I did that where I could walk into a publishing house and say, look, you know, it doesn't matter that they're individual poems and individual pages. It's a story, and you can sell it as a story. Sometimes they would call it poetry. Sometimes they wouldn't. It would just be a picture book, something like that. My work is with the Dewey Decimal System in several different places. But that was important to me. As my kids got older, I did older collections. I was interested, you know, when Lee was running track. I did I Am the Running Girl. When they both were doing a great deal of sports, I did Sports Pages, which was a collection of kids doing a variety, collection of poems. So that's a thematic collection. So I was able to do a thematic collection. When they got to be a little older and they were involved in their social activities, I did another book that was also a thematic collection that had to do with male, female, drugs, living their lives in a complex society. By no means have I covered all of the bases. And real life always, if I wrote things as a male that had a female protagonist, which I always enjoyed doing because you would take yourself and make yourself into another persona and test yourself. Could I be as valid? I wasn't taking a job away from a woman because nobody can do what each individual writer or painter or whatever could do. But to me, it was an exciting stretch. Today, my Facebook news feed has several groups of transgender and transsexual people who are out there showing photographs or being, you know, or sadly being tortured and destroyed and murdered. So reality has gone past where I have gone. And I don't know if I'll catch up with that, but there are other writers in their age groups who are doing their writing, and certainly the kinds of performance poetry that I don't do deals with gender roles and the multiplicity beyond the binary gender role and life and you know and as well as you know race and everything else. So I feel confident there's a wonderful generation. The struggle in the 60s was, let's say, Amiri Baraka and the black arts movement versus those black writers who wanted to follow in a European tradition when it came time to creating the process that was their black poetry. We don't really have that today. Sadly, Baraka's not here because it would be interesting to see what he said. He was a genius, just as James Baldwin was. There were geniuses that we were fortunate enough to do. Baldwin lived in our building, one floor below us on Horatio Street in the West Village. And along with everything else he did, he had time to take Virginia's first novel to his editor at Dial and try to get it published. And this is an adult novel that has never been published. So
how about making that transition into doing some reading?
I will. I just wanted to say that I have a blog. So to finish the story, I'm writing now for my peers for older young people and for my peers. And there are two kinds of writing. One is a collection that I attempt to do and to get published. So I'm doing the same thing I did when I was younger in the 60s, banging my head against the wall, trying to find an editor. The other thing is, through the wonders of Facebook, you meet a woman in Seattle who you've never met physically, but who's brilliant and bright and talented, a visual artist and a writer, she's white from a little town in Illinois, married a black guy from Troy, and they're out in some small town near, right outside of Seattle. But she also knows how to go to WordPress, and she knows how to take whatever I send her as an email and post it. And so she, thank goodness, you have to remember I don't drive, and that spreads out. My 9-year-old grandchild will say, "Grandpa, you're the only one who has no apps. Why don't you have an app?" And I don't have any apps because I messed up with the registering of it, and the name is not right, the password is broken and whatnot. Eventually I'll have an app or two. Beyond the flashlight, I have that in the weather, you know, but the stuff that comes with it. So we set up this blog, but I'm not really – so what that means is I do new work that I put directly for everybody to see. So I'm not trying to – I mean, it says copyright, but I'm not trying to keep it and then make a book out of it, although I'm tempted with once I get into the work of a few things. But to self-publish would be to take a collection I may read a few of these things, and then pay somebody to scan and make a book out of it and pay somebody else to do a jacket, and then a whole book is made, an e-book, and then you go to Amazon and they have millions of them. I'm not seduced by that approach, although I know many young writers do. They're sick and tired of waiting. Jamie was that way. 3, 4, 5 months, screw it. You know, it's life, you know, life is too short. Too many things I wanna do. But that doesn't appeal to me for a variety of reasons. With a publisher, brick and mortar, hardcover publisher, with all of the problems, you have a publishing house that publishes your work. And that means there are marketing people. If you can navigate the idiocy of what they or how they want to turn something really fine into oatmeal, so it will have a broad market. But if you can get past there, and at my age, I know how to get past there. And the work I do is very unusual. Either you love it or you hate it, and it's always been that way. But not only that, but you get a contract and you get an advance against royalties. And if it's an ebook to Amazon, you may get a contract, but you don't get an advance. So it doesn't, I'm not paying any mortgage anymore, but it doesn't help you to live, to get nothing for your work. And the way the ebook industry developed only 10, 15 years ago, really completely, is that the publishers may get 75% or 80% or, you know, even beyond. So it's nice if you download one of my poems, but you can download it for free. I don't mind the 16 cents that I'm missing. The copyright notice is pretty much so you protect your work. By the way, one small thing, I don't give the title of this new book because you can't copyright a title. And so you could publish a novel called Moby Dick if you wanted to. It's really unusual, but that's just part of the copyright world. So I learned that at an early age, and I'm still kind of weird about it. So also this woman who has the blog with me will agitate me if I'm not working on new stuff. Where are you still alive out in Ohio? What's going on? I haven't seen new stuff, and that's nice to get a little push. Virginia and I would almost subtly push each other that way. And to have a good editor, they set down deadlines, and they've got, you know, your work scheduled for publication. So I'm hoping some of these new things that are in a book will be published as a new book of mine. So I take my vitamins and do my rehab, and I'll try to make it another couple of years. You want to hear some poems?
Want to hear some poems.
Poets always have to read poems. This is one that I did last year, but it's relevant almost on a daily basis. And we should all be aware of the Colin Kaepernick situation and the fact that he's been blacklisted. By the way, isn't that interesting? If you go to the dictionary and all the negative pejorative words are black. Black ball, blackguard, blacklisted. I mean, by the dozens and dozens and hundreds. And I might go back a little bit to say, because I almost used the word minority. Virginia detested that word because it meant less than, really. And so we say minorities and black commentators and intellectuals many times are guilty of the same thing. She created a term called parallel cultures, and that was her approach. But this is a poem, so it's called "Take the Damn Knee, Stand with Left Behind Hand Behind Your Back and Right Hand Shooting Straight into Some Free Air, Fisting Hard with Rage and Historical Perspective and Mother Memories and Daily Images and Searing Words, Daily Words, Damn Stand or Sit or Turn Your Solid Back or Walk Away, Take the Damn Knee in All Your Power and Self-Love, Smile into All Mirrors." Periodically, and I don't know that much about the digital controlling, the digital aspects, but periodically it's easy for me to take something for a blog and put it on Facebook. So I, at age 82, that's one of the ways I agitate. That's an individual poem that's not part of a – you're smiling, so you like that? That was good.
I did like that.
All right. Here's one I actually was working on this morning, although it's been out there for about a year. But one of the nice things that's happening, probably Black Lives Matter gets credit, but certainly even before, just like in the 70s, when there was a residue of goodwill and feeling that there wasn't enough that was being done for kids, for education, did we see many, like some of my anthologies that were done in 73. Well, I published Black is Brown is Tan, which was a landmark book, but I also did the largest collection of black poetry ever, and that was called I Am the Darker Brother. But here we are now, regardless of what's coming from, you know, the White House or the Trump Tower, where publishers are getting the wonderful Cheryl and Wade Hudson, who have a black press called Just Us Press, and are distributed by Scholastic, by a major publisher, went to another publisher and said, "Look, we want to do a collection of poems that have specific focus. What do we tell the next generation? What do we tell young people?" And I can't give away the title of the book, but it's not something as prosaic as "What Do We Tell?" It's a powerful poem. And I said, go take a look and see what I'm doing and pick one. So they picked this one, and it's fairly recent. Here is a poem of love and hope from a cold December afternoon out here in the flatlands of East Ohio. And I am out in this considerable yard under this heavy gray sky pressing onto my shoulders. And sweet woman, my head is bending low as the song goes, and my eyes are fixed on frozen patches of my past and future loves and deaths and disregards. And I am living into my 80th year, and I still address these poems to you, to your eyes, to that always welcoming smile, to those welcoming arms. I am stripping away all that is not necessary, and this has been my plan, my process, for most of my conscious life out here, discerning what is alive and what is almost worth the mouth-to-mouth of the heart. And I still believe in the power and force of love, while I almost feel the land shaking with the power and force of mindful destruction, and I shake under the daily drumbeat of death. Please read this poem with your own power and love and smile and reread and nod and be angry within your full resolve. These struggles must continue through hard winter as we prepare for the new and greening spring. So they chose that one, and I think it's good. In general, I'm getting better as a writer. So by age 82, I really have a good bit of control. Dylan Thomas called it craft and sullen art, and I have a good bit of control over the sullen part of the art. You need hours more for me to go into process. But in general, I write shaped colloquial speech. So I am not a post-World War II Robert Lowell kind of confessional end-line rhyme scheme poet. I attempt to shape speech, and to do the easiest way is to say there's a balance between the rhythmic line of force and the semantic line of force. So there's a balance between the music and the meaning, and attempt to shape. And that's why you had talked before we came on the air about my feeling that the poem lives on the page. You have to read my poem to see what it looks like, because the shapes and the spacings have to do with the amount of beats and meanings that we put into. From Mingus, I learned that a 4-4 measure can have 5 beats and 6 beats and 7 beats. And it's, you know, and how do you do that? Well, it takes a lifetime to learn, you know, to learn how to do that. I have some pieces. So that's an individual piece as well. Do we have some? We have some time?
Yes? Yeah, we've got some time.
All right. Because the Nazis are killing people in the streets of America, and that's not a bad title for a poem, although probably 100 of my
sadly
100 of my colleagues are probably working on one that kind of starts like that. It is a coincidence that these poems have to do with the Nazis and the 1930s young teenage love, all happening together in Berlin today. If I sat at the table in my daughter's dining room in Berlin trying to write about this love story, feeling that what power can compare to death, maybe only love, maybe not, but it's all that I end up with after 82 years. But you sit at her table, and it's cold on your feet. They take their shoes off at the door and put on fuzzy slippers because there's a cold cellar and a storage area underneath her first floor floorboards, the apartment, and it's not difficult to imagine groups of people huddling and hiding down there in the 1940s all the way into 1943, 44. We don't realize till we research that there were Jews living in Berlin in the 1940s, not just the people who got out or who were carted away in the 1930s. So I realized that this book had to be those reverberations of the past and a contemporary love. So the book opens like this. Sometime around 5 in the morning, the doors down the street began to shake with rumbles of wheels of heavy trucks, and doors on hinges rumbled and gave way to fists and shoulders and the flat butt ends of rifles, and the Lowensteins and the Steins and the Lowies and all the other families began to fall into the street, to stand on the sidewalks like fallen painted theater flats, like years of seasons of leaves under winter trees, like still and silent wedding pictures left behind on dresser tabletops, already dead in wooden frames, already dead, already dead, already dead. You know the blood never washes entirely from stones, from streets, from cobbles, from microscopic remains of storefront glass shattered that Kristallnacht, night and day and night, and the next days and nights, nights without an ending night, and the next days and nights, nights without beginning, crystals reflecting still faces long into dust, into dust, into dust, dust. Who drove those trucks rounding up human cargo? I've seen photos of the families standing crowded in the back of those trucks, and in the Jewish Museum is the photo of that man who was at the front of one and threw his wallet over the high side down onto the street as the truck sped away. Have seen that wallet and its contents, identity cards and all, and cardboard markers of a life just at that moment, lost forever. But the identity cards of the drivers, their faces, hair and eye color, descriptions, height and weight, and place of residence, their homes, homes, homes. Pretend you can see through the stone walls of their buildings, and this wife, so soundly asleep, those children, some blonde baby content in its crib. Pretend I see those grown old men there, that one in a wheelchair being pushed across this busy street, and there sitting in the sun at that corner cafe table. And I think I'll end with one that takes the reader into the love affair between David, the Jewish kid from New Jersey, who falls in love with the young girl whose father is a black army officer, and the way we have so many in Germany, and a German mother. So they're in love, and they go out, and Oranienbergstrasse is the old Jewish quarter, which has been many ways revitalized and recreated. Oranienbergstrasse, and Strasse means street, Oranienbergstrasse, Saturday night in Berlin Central, Berlin Center, the Mitte section of the city, the middle, the street, like tourist streets every big city boasts. And on the old sidewalks, the crowds of people come and go, speaking of David and Lorelei walking hand in hand into that Thai restaurant, What a beautiful couple, and give them room to pass so they still are able to hold hands. And what a beautiful couple. And who is more beautiful? The tall, thin boy with the backpack and the long black curls sticking out of the sides of his New York Yankees cap. Or, that fine, tan, teen girl woman in quilted long coat and the shortest and darkest brown crown of curls, and the sky opens and the smiling face of the goddess shines down on us, and the sea of people parts in front of the beautiful beauty of this new world couple, and the bright round dome of the old Orionberg synagogue opens into the night sky in an explosion of light and warmth and the many colors of Jacob's ancient coat, and a chorus of 10 black-bearded angels sings them into their dinner, and love, oh, love, ah, love, and men and women weep and wipe wet eyes on cold winter sleeves and fall to the ground in praise of the wonder and triumph of some single kiss, and beat their chests and beg forgiveness on the self-same stones worn smooth with march and shuffle and shuffle and march and march and march and march and march. So we shall see how things go. I don't have a contract yet. The editor loves it and says I'm the best thing, not since sliced bread, but the best poet who ever lived on the face of the earth. But she's very fulsome with her praise. She doesn't go quite that far, but I'm in the middle of revising these things, so this is hot from my table in Yellow Springs, and we shall see how things go.
Thank you so much for sharing those with
my
us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Was that enough? That was enough.
That was enough. Yeah. And but we're going to close, but as we do, I just want to know if there is some last piece of wisdom you want to leave us with.
Well, we see, from the daily destruction of black life in this country, and the daily struggles to maintain even an even keel between destruction and Faulkner, when he got the Nobel Prize, to prevail, not just to survive. So we are struggling now mainly to survive, and we're struggling in an atmosphere where we don't know even if survival is going to be possible. But struggle we must, because we have no alternative. And resist. We must. And always in excellence. I can tell you, as a poet, as a human being, it's very difficult to not become so engrossed and enmeshed in the daily death and the daily repetition of what we thought was finally finished in 1945 and in 1965 or whatever. Very difficult to write love poetry, particularly. But in the end, that's really all I think that I have left. So that's my end. Really, we love and we attempt to create love within the hearts and the souls of the next generation. So I began this life of mine when I was 11 years old. So that's writing poetry for over 70 years. And I began in 1968 writing and publishing exclusively for young readers. And this is no time to this is no time for the faint of heart. you gather strength from the same videos that you see every day, and even by the tragic deaths that are encountered every day. And all you can do is attempt to gather strength and to continue to work with young people, as I know you do, and my son back here in Yellow Springs, and the struggle continues. What more can I say? It's been a pleasure. I like it very much. I will say that I enjoyed hearing again the interview that I did when I was 48, and I like being 82, but it was a strange experience to go back in time. I always try to go forward if I can. So, thank you.
Thank you, Arnold Dadoff.
Yes.
I appreciate so much you being here.
I think we covered all the bases.
I think we did, too.
We did, yeah.